of Olympia called Evolving Ideas. And in her show, over the last 6 years, she's interviewed some 200 people who are all involved in cutting-edge information. She is a moderator. She asks questions. She will be moderating your panel tonight. She'll be up on stage with our presenters. I don't know many people that could sit on a stage with these three gentlemen and exchange wits, but believe me, if anyone can do it, it is Elaine Smitha. Give a large round of applause for Elaine Smitha and for the unseen guests in our lives that can't be with us.
Well, I'm really happy to have you all here today, and I must say that it is such an enormous privilege to be in the company of these three brilliant scientists. And when I start talking about them, tears come to my eyes because you have no idea how I feel about this whole thing. My mission is to share knowledge, to bring you up to date so that we can progress into the next millennium with knowledge and intelligence and critical thinking ability. That's what this is about. And I really honor you for honoring yourselves, for bringing yourselves here today. This conference is going to examine the connection between Mars and free energy. There are coming some dramatic changes in our lives. And without that proper knowledge, you're going to have a hard time making it. How does Cydonia and Egypt and hyperdimensional physics and its geometry relate to an intelligent civilization to which we are all connected? And how does the knowledge of this make a difference in our lives? Could our own technological society be on the brink of extinction or interstellar travel? You are about to experience an unprecedented event, one that is pivotal to our future. And I acknowledge you for your wisdom in recognizing the importance of this by being here. Some of this is going to be technical, but what I've learned for myself is even when they're talking some numbers and stuff, and you don't really know how to formulate all of that, just don't get hooked on it. Don't stay there. Don't stop. Just let it flow in and keep moving with it. And stay with the concept, because we are going to have some technical work today. And I just invite you not to get hung up on that. Just move with it. And I'm sure that by the end of this event, you'll be very happy that you did, and you will have collated a great deal of knowledge. Now, Richard C. Hoagland is a very good friend of mine, and I brought him before some years ago to South Puget Sound area. And he and I have been friends over the years and have connected. And I was very honored when he accepted my invitation to come again to Seattle, but this time to the Seattle Center, and joined with the other two fine gentlemen. Richard really started off in science at a very early age, and was really trained in hard sciences and physics and other diverse interests, as you all well know. At 19, he was curator of the Museum of Science in Springfield, Massachusetts. Then he held special directorship at both the Gingrich and Hayden Planetarium. At 23, he was a science advisor to Walter Cronkite on the Apollo mission. He's been an editor-in-chief of the Star and Sky magazine. He's also been a consultant to NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and the author of Monuments of Mars. Please join me in welcoming this astounding man to start off this conference. Thank you. Richard C. Hoagland. Bless you.
Thank you, Elaine. We have a very complicated and very interesting weekend planned for everyone. And what I'd like to do is something totally different. Normally, when I've done the Bell Show, Art keeps telling me to get to the point. For some reason, he keeps saying that. It's like a, you know, like a mantra. So I thought I would completely break with type this morning and start with the point, and then work backwards. You know the 11th commandment, thou... Is this telling me something? All these years, and I thought I was doing it right. Okay, one can learn. The point, if I may kill the slide projector and have the first video, which almost needs no words, will be very obvious and self-evident. So let's start there, all right? Do we have a technician to start there? Ah, yes, James, who has been here since 6 o'clock this morning. All right, we're going to have these guys take a standing ovation at the end of the morning, all right? Okay. This should be kind of self-evident. So what we're going to do is run it through once and just let you watch it. And don't let them all fly in. That's all right, we can have sound. The date is August 6, 1997. The location is Mexico City, as one can tell from the Spanish in the background. The latitude is 19.5 degrees. Now we can turn the sound down. All right. This is now a series of computerized close-ups and enhancements of a remarkable object photographed on an average August morning, going behind a set of structures at the University of Mexico, including one which looks suspiciously like an astronomical observatory dome. Handheld camera. Large, spinning object, clearly under control, somewhat. Clearly, now this is negative, all right? You can see the size of the object. You can see that it hovers, and then it begins to move to the right. Notice its wobble motion, the so-called classic falling leaf motion. Behind the apartment complex. Critically important, because not only is it behind a distant set of structures of known scale, but it was witnessed by several dozen people, many of whom have shown up on the Mexican equivalent of 60 Minutes with Jaime Maussan, who is a friend of mine. And now what they're going to do is they're going to do close-ups in negative. There's one of the domes on top of the structure. Now, notice carefully that this thing is rotating. It is also rocking gently. It is clearly a massive, disc-like object. It is not, Colonel Dames, a hologram. It has shadows. Holograms don't have shadows. And it is clearly a real three-dimensional structure, an electrogravitic vehicle somehow defying the current laws of physics, photographed over perhaps the most populated city in the Western Hemisphere. And yet, has this video shown up anywhere on CBS, NBC, or ABC? Now this is an analysis which we're going to get into a little later on. Now what we've done here is in the computer we have frame stabilized so that the structure stands still. We're taking out all the handheld camera motion so that you're actually simply looking at the object. And we'll describe what you're actually seeing in terms of the physics of hyperdimensional connection a little later on. and this repeats several times. The point is that this is an astonishing piece of video in a planet wired for the internet, for global satellite communication, for instant stock transfers, for every facet of the wired electronic nervous system of the latter part of the 20th century. And yet right next door, we can't seem to get video from Mexico City to CBS, NBC, ABC, and CNN. Okay, we can kill the video, and please come back up with the slide projector. And that, in essence, is the problem, okay? Because if it were a level playing field, if, as my friend Art and others are wont to do, cringe at the C word, if we were not living in a conspiratorial political environment, this would have changed global history, if nothing else, in the summer of last year. Instead,
it's
on the internet, and it's run on sightings, and, you know, but it's fringe. It's those folks that look at that stuff. You know, it's not Monica. And last night, I thought that Dr. Greer was extremely elegant, along with Steve Bassett, when on Art's show, they basically call what's going on in Washington the most extraordinary and the most dangerous travesty of the latter part of the 20th century. Because while that is going on, while the national attention is focused myopically and stupidly on something that is irrelevant to 6 billion human beings, minus two. What else is going on that we're not being allowed to pay attention to? What are we missing? What's wrong with this picture? Well, what's wrong with this picture is that an obvious vehicle built by someone, and I have strong suspicions that what you saw is ours, and we'll lay out the case for that tomorrow, passes completely unnoticed and unseen, even though it occurs in broad daylight over one of the most populated cities on Earth, and literally tens of thousands of people look up and see it, and dozens take video and sit on television and report about it and are agog over it and what it could mean. There's something wrong with this picture. Well, as I have been wont to say over the last, 15 years, you know, we don't do UFOs. Some folks don't do windows, and we don't do UFOs. As of this morning, shortly after 10, on August 26th, we have broken that rule. And the reason we've broken that rule is it's flagrantly obvious, if nothing else, that a, quote, UFO, an unidentified flying object, hovering on some kind of extraordinary electrogravitic field over the most populated city in the Western Hemisphere at 19.5, somehow connects to what we have discovered at Cydonia, if only through that latitude. So, for those who may have been asleep for the last 15 years, let me take you quickly through how we got here. Because what we're going to do with this technology, what we can do with this technology, what we need to do with this physics and technology, is in essence the summation of the weekend. We have with us two very good friends and eminent colleagues, Dr. Van Flandern and Tom Bearden. Tom Van Flandern is going to present to you a problem, an extraordinary problem, which sooner or later is going to confront the human species. He is going to limb out potentially an extraordinary genesis for that problem. But if it were left to Tom, there's nothing that we can do about this problem except look up and maybe duck. What Tom Bearden is going to do is, at the end of this afternoon and more tomorrow, is to lay out the stunning opportunities based on the physics behind what you have just seen on that screen for dealing with the problem that Tom Van Flandern will carefully and brilliantly illuminate. And by the end of the weekend, what you are going to hopefully come away with from this series of discussions, including tonight, is a very profound feeling that, yeah,
We're immersed in something very deep and very complex, and there are some very nasty players who do not want us to know what's going on and will do anything to confuse and distract and delude us. On the other hand, this is still a Jeffersonian republic. And the fact that you're here and the fact that you can take action, the fact you can pick up the phone and call your senator and congressman and provide them with copies of the video that is being filmed this weekend so they can see in one-stop shopping format problem and solution, extraordinary opportunity as representatives in this republic should be presented with new options. That's where you come in. That's where the whole idea of the democratic ideal comes to the fore, where, as my trucker friends say, the rubber meets the road. Because if you leave here after tomorrow and you look back and say, oh, that was a really neat weekend, yeah, and nothing changes, then when the things that are going to happen that we're going to lay out do occur, you'll have no one to blame but yourself. But the fact that on this gorgeous, sunny Seattle day, you're here and not out there, is testimony that you want to do something. You want to be a player. You want to make a difference. Well, hopefully, in this weekend, we can show you how to make the difference. So, without further ado, let me just click through a couple things here. My journey, my search for some answers and for some context for what you have seen, began about 15, well, actually more like 22 years ago, when I was in the audience at JPL and this photograph popped up on the screen. And it was something so unexpected, so bizarre, that none of us really believed that it was real. I mean, it looked like something that you'd expect out of a sci-fi novel. A humanoid face lying on the planet Mars, staring straight up at a camera, looking down from 1,000 miles overhead. Oh, come on. Give me a break. I mean, it was kind of as outrageous as what we just showed you in that video. But subsequent work, going back now over those 15 years, in part put together by ourselves in the form of the various independent scientific teams, initially based at SRI, then the University of California, and then truly independent as Enterprise is now, have led to the input of a lot of good people in the field. Computer experts, geomorphologists, geologists, people with familiarity in the background of Martian environment and aerionomy and surface processes, as well as a whole host of cultural expertise, ranging from artists to mythologists and even a few historians. And the sum total of what we have figured out, which we laid out in a series of videos starting with our first Lewis presentation at NASA back in 1991, all right, is that we are dealing in these images with nothing more, nothing less than constructed artifacts on the surface of Mars. This was, if you follow the math, this was fairly apparent even before this spring. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to weave together the science and the politics, at least this morning in terms of Cydonia, because what happened this spring was the most incredible sleight of hand on the part of NASA that anyone has ever seen. It's like when you put a picture up and you call it something else and everybody says, oh, I don't see that. I see that's something else you're calling it. We live in a culture where it is so difficult for people to make an independent assessment, to come to an independent conclusion, because we're trapped in the mode of authority figures. If Bill Clinton, well, maybe that's not a good example right now, if Al Gore were to go on television hosting that video I just showed you, there would be worldwide pandemonium. If I went on television and shown it, 90% of the audience would look at it and say, oh, come on, Hogan faked it. There's no way that's real. It had to be fake. Same video, two different people, two different perceptions of authority figures. So in a world where we are trapped by authority figures, where we cannot figure out reality unless someone in authority tells us what reality is, and we're moving further and further down that road in certain domains, it is very difficult indeed to perceive reality for what it really is. That's why I am so excited every time I get feedback from the radio and the media that I do, when I find people independently thinking, people not accepting what authority figures are telling them, but look at data and ask the important questions as to what does it really, truly mean. So what we're going to try to do this weekend is to answer the question, finally, after all these years, in a larger context, what does Cydonia truly mean? Do we have enough information now, based on the results from 20 years ago, based on the new data from the Mars Surveyor mission of this spring, and those three grudging images that NASA kicking and screaming finally gave to us, which we'll go into in some detail in a few minutes. Do we have enough evidence now to come to a decision about what Cydonia might mean and how it fits into a larger set of puzzles, including what could well be our own fate in the not too distant future? When I started looking at Cydonia, when I started looking at these structures, this of course is as a structure not on Mars, this is the Sphinx in Egypt, lying right out in front of the Great Pyramid. The Khefren Pyramid is also over here. All right. When I started looking at these structures, this is the face on Mars in a 3D color projection from Dr. Mark Carlotta, who's one of the people who over the years has done tremendous labors in these vineyards. The obvious question that rose to my mind and has risen to a lot of other people is there a potential connection between what we're seeing on Mars, pyramids and a sphinx, and what we see on the Giza Plateau here, right on Earth, in Egypt? And the bottom line answer, of course, is yes, overwhelmingly, stunningly. Because as you're going to see, not only do we find these two places, these two sites, are linked geodetically, the latitude of Cydonia is, in round numbers, 41 degrees. The latitude of Giza, in round numbers, is 30 degrees. The tangent of one is the cosine, of the other. So there is a geodetic link in the math, linking one to the other. But far more profound, this guy, which is the Great Sphinx of Egypt, for thousands of years, has represented an ineffable, mysterious, looming visage in the sand, a man-lion fusion, a hominid feline image. That feline image overwhelms some of us so often that they take nicknames like tiger, but that's a whole other discussion. Anyway, the symbology behind that fusion has been profoundly mysterious up until now. And today we're going to lay out some possible answers to that mystery, because what we find on Mars is this connection between man and lion, man and feline, is in fact connected through Cydonia. Out in front of the pyramids, which of course you see here, the so-called city, there is this extraordinary object, which is the focal point of a set of sight lines projected off toward the northeast. And we're going to show some imagery shortly, including imagery from the new mission, from Mars Surveyor, which profoundly now connects this man-lion image in a place where it has no business being, on the sands of Mars. This is a trek that I began at the UN in 1992, when I did that presentation in February. And if you've seen the video of that presentation, you know that when we showed the left-right imagery of the Viking data from Cydonia, there was this visible, audible gasp from the folks assembled in the auditorium there at the United Nations. Because at some deep, visceral level, this symbology strikes a profound chord. There is a profound meaning. A meaning which some in our society would just as soon prefer we never think about. because it takes us places where, in the idiom and the lingo of these times, we don't want to go. So the alignments which we have looked at over the years at Sidonia, the geometric relationships between when you stand next to this object and look out at that object, were very reminiscent early on of other alignments that I had looked at, namely alignments at a place called Stonehenge. It turned out ultimately that as we moved through the geometry and the mathematics, those connections were more than merely metaphoric. They turn out to be telling us some of the same geometric stuff, the stuff which is going to connect with what Tom Bearden is going to tell you this afternoon by way of a physics which has literally lain fallow. An original set of ideas created over 100 years ago by people like Maxwell and Faraday and others, and for some reason sidetracked from where physics and science went in the last 100 years, the last century. We are now in the process of seeing a renaissance, which brings us back not only to these seminal ideas for how to really work with the world, with the universe, but there is exquisite connections, it turns out, in places such as this, we find the same mathematics, which of course is impossible. I mean, the guys that built this place, we know were, you know, bare-skinned savages, barely grunting at each other, right? Of course. And who possibly built Sidonia? And what possible connection could they have with the savages who built this place? Well, it turns out that, like that book that's out there, most of what I thought I knew was wrong. Most of what we have been taught is wrong. Not only in the sciences, but in archaeology, in anthropology. I mean, this is an extraordinary sweeping statement, which if I had several weekends, I could very easily now document based on work of everybody from Richard Thompson and Michael Cremo to Virginia, is it Steenburgen? Now I'm thinking Steenburgen, who is the actress, but it's not her, it's Virginia Steen, yeah. So as you begin to open these closets and you begin to find out that what's behind the door is not what you were told, at some point you kind of get the message that, wait a minute, somebody wants us to believe a fairy tale. Somebody has crafted this exquisite set, and we're kind of in the middle of it, and they control what we see and hear. It's kind of like that blip on the outer limits. We'll control all the vertical and the horizontal and all that you see and hear. Well, someone has been controlling what the human species has seen and heard for a very long time. And it's only in the latter days, in the last few moments of the 20th century, that we have the technology to get around the filters and figure things out and communicate them at a whole new level for ourselves. It's no wonder that there are some people who believe that these are the final days. Well, for a lot of paradigms, it is the final days. And who's going to write what's coming, what's new, what's maybe very, very old? We are, by simply demanding the truth. So we have this stunning geometry all over this place called Sidonia. And people in NASA say, oh, you can draw lines anywhere. Well, yes, you can. But you can't draw lines that are replicative of a geometry found on other planets all over the solar system, or ultimately resolved down to a physics of how to change the world. That's what makes these lines so radically different. And I'm not going to bore you with how we got these lines, but they're part of the video archive of the presentations we've done at NASA and other places over the years, and they're, of course, in my book, The Monuments of Mars. Where this has led us, of course, is to a stunning series of connections in history and mythology. Toward the end of this year, about last week, 2 weeks in December, and the first week in January, we are in the process of looking very heavily and carefully at taking a group of people and some celebrities from Hollywood and musicians from the 60s. We found where they're all hiding, all right? And we're going to take them to Israel and Egypt for a remarkable pre-millennial experience. And part of what I'm doing up here is I'm having some meetings on Monday with some of the folks that are helping bring this about. One of the things we're going to be doing is demonstrating in this tour, and no, this is not the tour, this is some of the geometry that will be part of the tour, that a lot of the sacred sites of the most troubled and contentious piece of real estate on this planet, bar none, this little region right nestled on the eastern side of the Mediterranean, those sacred sites are sacred because they contain and codify and replicate and link to each other with the same geometry that we found in the monuments of Mars. It is called sacred geometry. Do you ever wonder why the term sacred geometry came to be, other than somebody venerated it, somebody thought it was special? Well, it turns out it is special because it's the doorway, the geometric metaphor, to use a term from my friend Stan Tenen, who is going to be on the trip from the Meru Foundation. It is the geometric doorway beyond these three physical dimensions. It's that simple. It's the codification of the doorway to the transcendent and the infinite. And so, of course, it's sacred, because it's connecting this reality, this experience, with something else, what one might even term the other side. So we're going to explore that in a little detail this weekend, particularly as it comes back to Tom Bearden's work. Because it's one thing when you talk about transcendence in metaphor, when you talk about spirituality in concept, it's another thing when someone lays out the tools for how you actually can work with it, either in terms of a piece of technology or in its ultimate purest form with the technology we've been given up here. And that's what Tom is going to do. And the other Tom, and we tried to find Harry, but he wasn't around, so we're stuck with, you know, Tom, Tom, and Dick. The other Tom is going to tomorrow lay out for you how we're beginning now to suspect that this soap opera played itself out. What happened to other members of the solar system? What happened to Mars as a result of what happened to those other members? Were there folks living out there? Were they somehow connected to us? And did somehow, as refugees, or as refugee information, did this incredible echo of a stunning history to which we have been closed off for thousands of years, did it somehow make its way to Earth and become codified in the most contentious region on this planet, in the most sacred traditions of this planet, as a window to an experience and a time literally incomprehensible to most people living here and now? And is it possible that these most incredible sacred traditions are in fact reflections of a time when we were so much more? In other words, is the fall not just a metaphor, or not to be interpreted the way certain fundamental interpreters have interpreted it? That's some of the places that Dr. Van Flander, Yale graduate, is going to go. That's how far out this weekend is going to become. I hear giggling. This, of course, is one of the key Rosetta Stones of this puzzle. This is the same D and M pyramid, which I named after DiPietro and Molinar, when I realized that instead of being a regular four-sided little jobby, about a mile on a side, it's not very little, it's actually five-sided. And Errol Torin, my friend at Defense Mapping, in 1988, soon cracked the code of this five-sided structure, and that code is the same math which is underlying Tom Bearden's physics. It's the same math underlying the process whereby you blow up the worlds that Tom Van Flandern is going to talk to you about. It's the same math that allowed you to build starships, the same math that's the foundation of that extraordinary electrogravitic anti-gravity technology. And the core numbers of this math, of course, are 19.5, the angle at which a tetrahedron in a sphere touches, in a rotating sphere, and 19.5 degrees, which we found over and over again at Sidonia, and shows up now inside this elegant geometry, is, of course, the latitude of Mexico City, where something on an August afternoon hung in the skies over the city and went boom. And you're not supposed to know any of this. Somebody does not want you to know this, and you should be damn mad, because this is as much of your heritage as who the Sumerians were, or the slave experience of black Americans, or the fact that we overthrew the chains of a king of England and set up this extraordinary experiment, and there's a bell in Philadelphia with a crack in it that celebrates liberty, which is really another guise for the goddess Isis, which is a projection of the nearest brilliant star in the sky called Sirius, which will align precisely on the meridian at Giza at midnight, which is why we want to be there for the first time in 13,000 years. And somehow, 400 years ago, Pope Gregory knew this because the whole calendar got switched to bring that alignment to the meridian, and for no other reason, and we can prove it. The world you have been allowed to inhabit is about that much of an infinite universe which we truly inhabit. You talk about slavery. Slavery used to be you'd tie people up in chains and you'd hold a gun to their head and you'd make them do things. Modern slavery is you fill them with television, you fill them with Monica stories, you fill them with stores, you let them run around at the mall, and they never ask, what the hell are we really doing here and what's being taken from us while we're not looking? The gatekeepers since Nazi Germany have gotten a great deal more sophisticated. But people asking questions have also. And now we have the internet. And believe me, without the internet, we would not be able to do what it is that we are doing, and we are making progress. Last night, I heard Art Bell say hyperdimensional physics 4 times. Keith told me, he says, keep at it, you're making progress. So, hyperdimensional physics. It all comes down to the properties of this basic geometric device, the tetrahedron inscribed within a sphere. And no, I'm not bored, I'm just checking to see what kind of time we got, okay. That is the fundamental message of Sidonia. It's kind of like when you cared enough to leave the very best, instead of Kilroy was here. What they left us encoded in these extraordinarily ancient and really ineffable ruins, which are not like the Egyptian pyramids. I mean, some of our friends over in the SPSR group, the McDaniel group, I guess were really looking for, you know, limestone things with blocks built up like Giza. And they didn't understand what they were seeing when they didn't see that. What we're seeing at Sidonia is something so much more incredible and profound and light years beyond current 20th century comprehension, unless you think really big and have read an awful lot of Arthur Clarke, that it's not on the radar screen for most archaeologists, let alone other kinds of scientists like geologists. But it's coding all resolved down to this one simple form in a sphere. Why? Because the tetrahedron in a sphere literally predicts where energy in a rotating planetary or stellar environment will appear. There's an exquisite geometry. It doesn't appear at random. And that geometry is a clue to this universal process. And it's that geometry, again, at 19.5, where that UFO appeared, where a lot of them have been appearing ever since the eclipse of 1991 on July 11th. Why has Mexico City, 19.5, become a focal point? When I ran into Jaime Musson, who was the anchor for Mexico City's 60 Minutes program, it was at an airport, and he was at one end, I was at the other end, and we kind of walked toward each other, the first words out of his mouth were, "Geek, 19.5. And we had never talked. He had figured it out. He'd seen the UN thing. He knew where he was standing when he's looking at all this stuff and all these videos. And he'd figured out that somebody was within the keeping of the non-interference prime directive. Remember that one? The conception of my departed friend Gene Roddenberry? Well, where did Gene get this? Maybe Gene was tapped into something. Maybe Star Trek is part of the educational enlightenment get with the program guys program. For those of us who have been following it over the years and looked at all the themes and all the plot lines and all the questions it has posed in a form that, quote, ordinary people can understand. Well, it starts with what's going on this planet at 19.5, which happens to be Hawaii. Or what's going on Jupiter at 19.5, which happens to be the Great Red Spot. This is, by the way, on Mars, which is Olympus Mons. The largest field volcano in the solar system has come up on Mars at 19.5 degrees. There's Hawaii down here by scale, by comparison. There's Olympus Mons. Why the difference? Because this planet, all right, there's nothing moving around on the surface. It just sits there and the lava kept pumping and pumping and pumping and pumping and the whole side of the planet is bulged out. On Earth, we have these plates that move around, so it's like putting a cigarette under a piece of paper. You'll get burn marks at different places across the paper as you move it across the cigarette. So there's not enough time to build up the equivalent pile of lava, but the process is exactly the same on two separate worlds. And that's how we know, that's how we knew we were on to something profound, because science begins, all science begins in a pattern. It's only later that you figure out what the pattern means. And it means for Mars that Mars has had a profound history, some of which has been determined by what's going on inside, and other parts of it determined by what's been going on outside. And this again is the geometry relating to Cydonia, because if Olympus Mons is here, one tetrahedron vertex over, here is a meridian of 9.5 degrees west, and up at 41 degrees north latitude, there sits Cydonia. So the very placement of Cydonia on Mars, by whoever did it, and the strong suspicion that I have come to, and I think I'll have some words to say about it tomorrow, is it was us. It's like Charlie Brown. I look around here, and I'm looking out there, and we think we're looking at aliens, and it turns out the aliens is us. That we have done stunning, exquisite, extraordinary things in the solar system, and like amnesia, for some reason the curtain came down, and somebody now does not want us to remember what we used to do and who we really are. And frankly, I'm pissed. And you should be too. And it can change. It is changing. That's the extraordinary thing. It is changing. Art said hyperdimensional physics 4 times last night. All without prompting. I was elsewhere. Okay, this is just a symbol. We won't need to go there. This relates it to Jupiter. This extraordinary vortex, because tetrahedra are solid state forms of vortices, which is how this physics operates in the universe. The first mission we sent to Neptune back in 1989 in August, Voyager 2, as it began to take photographs, it spotted a dark spot, and some colleagues and I were taking bets that it would live at 19.5, and sure enough, it did. That's how you know you're onto it. Well, if we can figure out the physics of whole worlds, what about whole suns? During the impromptu Q&A, I heard there were some questions relating to the sun and other stars, directed to Dr. Van Flander. Well, Tom's an astronomer, and one of the neat things about Tom is he's an open-minded astronomer. He has been dealing with a very thorny problem, namely, he's got this nasty habit. He's wanting to blow up solar systems. We're trying to cure him of it, all right? We have him in therapy, you know, AAA, Atomic Ancient Astronauts Anonymous. But it's pretty difficult to imagine a power source, an energy source adequate to do the job. There is this wonderful movie called Forbidden Planet. How many of you have seen Forbidden Planet? All right? Okay. The rest of you, go out and see it. It's a blockbuster. Go rent it. You'll have a heck of an interesting evening, particularly after what I'm about to say. There's a line in it where they're down in the super laboratory of the Krell. Forbidden Planet is a metaphor for us and what happened on Mars. There. See, I've given it away. Now you'll look at Walter Pidgeon in a whole new light. All right? And there's this great scene down in the laboratory where the monster, you know, is at the door of the super laboratory, trying to get in. And there's this bank of power meters running around the room. And each one is 10 times the one preceding it. And, I mean, they run on for, it looks like, miles. And there's this great scene where Leslie Nielsen, back when he was an actor and not who he is now, you know, says, Dr. Morbius, do you see that, those meters, you know, your monster will have the power of 10 times 10 times 10 to the power of infinity to get through that door. And it's such an exquisite image because the power of hyperdimensional physics, the power that Tom Bearden is going to lay out today and tomorrow, is literally 10 times 10 times 10 to the power of infinity. It's all the amount of power anyone could ever imagine being able to use. It's the power to create or to destroy entire worlds. And it's the power, we are strongly coming to believe, that fuels the stars, that fuels the sun. Not nuclear physics, nor the physics that we've been taught since World War II, you know, banging up H-bombs and compressing them and containing them. That's part of the delusion. That's part of the wrong trail physics has taken. The real physics is so much more extraordinary and, in fact, can do, under weird circumstances, the same things in the sun, inside planets, and then, poof, no more place to stand. So this is what somebody doesn't want you to think about too much, because the market will go down. Too unstable, you know. Last night, remember what Art said, based on what Greer was talking about? How NASA folks at higher levels are talking about there's a great deal more instability on this planet than they're willing to admit. It's underreported. Well, for good reason. You don't tell the sheep that the pen might not be around for a lot longer, at least in the form to which they're accustomed. I mean, where would we go if the moles were destroyed? Anyway, so this physics has non-trivial implications. And the neat part about it is that Tom Bearden's work, and my work in this area, come at this from two totally separate directions. Tom, if you really press him, I think he knows the difference between a planet and a star. I think. All right? But he's not astronomically minded. He's been focused on lab benches and musty tomes of reconstructing the real history of physics and all that. I'm the guy that looks out at the stars and lives in a place where you can really see them. And one of the neat things that I discovered was that as we decoded Cydonia and tracked through the math and figured out the elements of how it works, as I began to look at this, I realized that for the last 30 years, since the 60s, the astronomy has given us answers to some of these very same questions. Because right in our own backyard, beginning in the 60s, they started looking at the planets with infrared telescopes. And they discovered this pretty amazing thing. I mean, the standard canonical textbook definition of the difference between a star and a planet is a star shines by its own light, its own energy, and a planet reflects light. Right? Simple. Wrong, Paleface. Said that to Art one night. All right. The reason it's wrong is because we found out, when we started looking at these planets in the infrared, that the outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, are all emitting more energy than they're getting from the sun, than they're reflecting from the sun. Now, where's the energy coming from? They don't know. They wave their arms a lot. They talk about helium drip. That's the kind you have after coffee in the morning, all right? But they don't know. Because they're not plugged into the hyperdimensional model. They don't know that the universe is awash in energy because it's a bubble as part of a larger reality. It's not a matter of creating something from nothing, it's a matter of tapping into the other something so that it can get through to the little something that we inhabit. It's like living in the shadow of Boulder Dam. And there's this sluice that runs by your house. And all your life, no one has ever asked the question, where's that water coming from? You've just seen this huge wall, but it's so huge, it takes up the universe. It's your sky, and it becomes such a part of reality that it's too big to be part of your reality. You assume that it's just a thing. And someday, one day, some bright kid, they're always kids, right, says, well, the water's coming out from behind that huge wall, and if we put this little wheel in it, we can make electricity. And somebody says, oh, but you can't. You know, our universe is closed. It's finite. Where eventually, the water will run out. The dam, there is no dam, of course. The amount of energy is finite. It will eventually run down, and there's no way we can create anything from it. Not realizing that there is an infinite amount of energy stored behind that concrete wall called Boulder Dam. Well, the demarcation between dimensions is like the concrete of Boulder Dam. There's an extraordinary amount of energy stored in higher state spaces, and as Tom will describe, the math exists now. It existed 100 years ago to describe, maybe not conceptualize, but to mechanically describe the process of gaining access to that energy. And what he's going to lay out is that what we have done in the last 100 years, what they have done, a few days, not very many, and everybody else followed suit very obediently, right down the little cattle chute, right to the end. They have redefined arbitrarily the concept of energy. And by redefining it in a certain way, they've made it invisible to science. It's the most incredible sleight of hand you've ever seen. Because if you define it back the way it should be defined, suddenly you realize that we are awash in all kinds of energy. Oh, and I forgot to tell you, the power companies won't be able to charge for it. And that's why you've not been allowed to see it for the last 100 years. Because we are living in the illusion of scarcity. We are living in the illusion of want, of loss. In order to make you susceptible to control, they have to make you feel like you're nothing and they're something. You know, it's like that line, Chevy Chase. I'm Chevy Chase and you're not. Well, they're them and you're not. And they have redefined your reality. It is so incredibly pernicious. And it's all done with equations and words. The physics is still there. But it's been made invisible because we live by definitions. And unless you kick over definitions regularly, as Thomas Jefferson said, a healthy revolution every 20 years is useful, you won't be able to see what's behind the curtain. The Wizard of Oz, by the way, is one of my favorite films. Because the guys behind the curtain have really had fun. And the game is about over. And the truth is about to dawn. And the truth is all around us. We look at these planets and we find that starting with Jupiter, it's emitting almost twice as much energy out as it's getting from any known source. Now, you can quibble about Jupiter because it's so big and it could be leftover heat from the beginning, but not about Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Not about the Earth. And when we get a little further out in the next day or two, I'll show you a very elegant graph I created, which overwhelmingly demonstrates that this physics is what's driving the outputs of the planets, like the Sun, and not the physics that we have been given. So we're up for revolutions all around. This is simply a mathematical construct. It's the 27-line model, which is the basis of this physics. We won't bore you with that. It loops around to the connections between us and Mars. And in the time I have remaining, it loops around to what happened this spring. Because one of the inelegances, if we can have the side projector off, and I will do this, which I think I can do. It should be there. Nope. Why are we not getting the computer? Thank you. Never thought you'd ask. By the way, there is such a thing as karma, or a god. It turns out that one of the possible people who are going to fund our trip to Egypt is Pepsi. So all these years I've been drinking this stuff, and finally it's going to come back to me. See, there is transcendent reality. Okay, let's see if this is going to work now. There. All right. As you all know, this spring, after much kicking and screaming and wailing and gnashing of teeth, and oh, we can't do it, and oh, we can't target it, we're only going to fly over it once, and oh, there could be clouds, and oh, we might kill the spacecraft, and oh, I'm going to freak out, Michael Malin somehow, magically, mysteriously gave us three, count them, three images of Cydonia. Bing, bing, bing. Every 9 days. Very hyperdimensional, Mike. These are the images. And the first image was down right across the face. The second image was down on the west side of town. This is the city complex. And the third image was supposed to get the fort. You know, he missed the fort. Poor guy. Anyway, the third image is laid out here. Now, the background of these images was rather intriguing. There was, as you know, a lot of discussion in previous years about what happened to Mars Observer. And there are some of us who, I know, we just can't be broken of this nasty habit. We think that the incredibly opportune disappearance of the Mars Observer spacecraft 2 days before it was supposed to reach Mars, right after I debated Bevan French on Good Morning America, where the ABC correspondent basically said it on behalf of all the press, look, NASA, just take the damn pictures and show these turkeys are wrong. And they couldn't. So they didn't. And the whole damn thing disappeared. Well, did it really disappear? Did it really blow up? These are questions, unless we get a piece of paper, we are never going to know. But the count got recycled. A duplicate camera from Dr. Malin's group was flown on Mars Surveyor. And this spring, wonder of wonders, we actually got a view, a look at the second set of images taken in 22 years from the Malin camera, taken to Mars in April of this year. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go down a series of thingies here. I could basically do this all in the dark and then just pop them up, but I'm going to just let the computer run because it's a lot simpler, all right? This is the comparison of the first two strips that were taken by means of the camera on Mars Surveyor. On April 5th, as they flew in this special science orbit, and we won't get into the reason that the mission got delayed and they now have the opportunity to point the spacecraft and take these images, in April of this year they took the first image, April 5th, and sent it back a day or so later to JPL, and then on 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, over a long weekend where not any fingernails were left, the picture came in. And CNN popped up this picture, and I'm going to show you what it shows. There it is. See? Your tax dollars at work. Now, by comparison, I should tell you that this camera had been functioning for months and months and months previously and had returned, you know, several hundred photographs of other parts of Mars. And you know, they really were there. You could really see something. But this image, when it came in, it was very, very dark. It was kind of like taking a photograph of a black cat, the interior of a black cat, during an eclipse at midnight. And I'll get to some of the other problems shortly. Why is that overloading? It should not be overloading. It's not on my screen. It appears. Can we turn the gain down perhaps a little bit on the display? Is that a possibility? It should not be overloading. All right. Let me just grab this and I'll show you where the face is, because the image on the left is the raw. The image on the right, you know, we don't want NASA to get blamed for things it's not responsible for, all right, is the enhancement which came out within a few minutes of the image on the left, which was an absolutely untouched image. Friend, a few minutes after the photograph came out, this is the raw, and you can now, because it's been so enhanced on this screen, you can see that there is an image there. This one, which is the first JPL enhancement, actually showed, it was flipped geometrically in the computer, and it began to show that there, in fact, was an image there of something. Now, the something was of such stark contrast and such poor quality that it was very difficult for anyone to really discern what the something was. In fact, it was so bad that somebody called in to ART that night and termed it the cat box image, because it looked like what your cat does in the sand, or the, and it did not look anything like the images that we had been expecting. For one thing, it was taken at an oblique angle. For another thing, it was taken during winter, and the original Viking image was taken during summer. And for a third thing, it was taken at around 10 o'clock in the morning, local time, versus 6 o'clock in the evening, local time, for the image 20 years ago. So the lighting was from the bottom, from the chin up. It's like taking a flashlight in front of a mirror in your bathroom and holding it under your chin and expecting someone to recognize you. All right? Try taking some pictures and sending them around to your friends and see if anybody recognizes you with that lighting. In other words, Mike Malin and company picked the worst geometry, lighting, and time of day to take the first new picture of Sidonia in over 20 years. Isn't that interesting? Now, you wouldn't imagine that that was deliberate, would you? Nah, that would be invoking the dreaded C word. No. So the image was popped up on CBS and NBC and ABC, and that renowned geologist Dan Rather pronounced it just just a pile of rocks. Now, Peter Jennings was fairer. Peter put me on and let me say a few words, and then he said it was a pile of rocks. But at least he had point-counterpoint. So ABC wins for fairness. Not for accuracy, but for fairness. CNN, you know, John Holloman, my dear departed friend, who I will miss, had asked the most profound questions during the process and was the only one of the network correspondents to pressure Dan Golden to take more pictures. The most intriguing part was that when we started looking at the data, we found that the original data coming in on the image here on the left had somehow mysteriously vanished. Normally a grayscale picture, whether it's a Mac or a PC, has 256 shades of gray. Now, not all pictures have that many shades of gray. Some, most of them have 120, 140, maybe 180, something like that. This one had only 42. What was even more remarkable is that the blacks didn't start down here. In other words, if you have no light, you basically start way down over on the left. Yeah, you're not going to have a lot of bright stuff, but the lack of data in the camera produces the dark, low DN numbers, digital numbers. So you'd expect that this would be over here to the left, where the grayscale starts. Instead, it was moved suspiciously to the right, like someone had gone in to the original and had chopped a version, had made a clone, and had popped it up on the JPL and NASA websites and the mirror sites all over the world and represented it as the original picture. And when we actually went into the site and looked at the actual curve, normally you'll see a Gaussian curve. You see a few little outliers down at the bottom, a few outliers at the top, and there's this bump in the middle. This is the image on the left here. This is the enhancement, and it only had 42 DN numbers. When we enlarge it, that's actually not what I want to do. I want to do this. All right, when we enlarge it and bring it to the next level, you can see that even on the enhancement that JPL put out that first afternoon, which was probably a couple hours after the image came back, you can't really see much of anything at all. The infamous cat box image, which is here, just does look like something that the cat dragged in, and we were told that we had to live with it. Well, one of the bizarre things about this is that when Dr. Malin was queried, and we were one of the folks who was very assiduously querying him in that afternoon and in several subsequent days, what he said was, well, the image was dark, you know, middle of a cat during an eclipse, et cetera, because it was cloudy on Mars. Now, how many here know the term Lambert scattering, having nothing to do with my former friend at JPL or at SRI? This is the wide-angle image that was taken simultaneous with the narrow-angle image, which is depicted right here as the little square. And now, of course, you can see the detail, all right? Now, what is it that we notice about this image? That it is bright. If I'm in orbit looking down on sun-illuminated clouds, the light is going to be kicked back toward the camera, toward space. How could Michael take a narrow-angle picture in the middle of this bright white stuff and have it come out dark? His puzzlement, as Yul Brynner would say. Or inquiring minds would really like to know, as the inquirer would say. And it's probably more toward the inquirer-level question than it is toward the Yul Brynner-level response, because obviously there is not real optical physics behind the assertion that, well, it was a cloudy day on Mars, therefore it was dark. If I'm above the clouds looking down, as any five-year-old kid flying in an airplane knows, it will be bright down there as opposed to dark. So, for a variety of reasons, I am more than dubious of Dr. Malin's quick response to why it looked so dark. Well, then we get into the content of the images, all right? And we see things like this. This is now the third enhancement which JPL gave us. This is the raw, so-called. This is the first enhancement. And then later on that evening, in fact, while we were doing art show, a gentleman named Tim Parker at JPL came out with this version. This is the Parker enhancement. Now, what I want to do is I'm going to focus this right about like this, and you'll see the difference between the JPL enhancement and the Parker enhancement. Notice that there's almost no grayscale here. It's basically black and white. I mean, you're stretching those 42 little shades of gray. And it doesn't work. It just makes it more contrasty. This one just looked instantly as if it was a better version of what was supposed to be the raw image. Remember, between the raw image here and this, all they did was turn up the contrast. No more data between here and here and here, supposedly. Except there's a lot more gray levels in here than there is in here, and certainly in here. So the suspicion, and again, we don't have the memos, we can't prove this, but the suspicion is that this is a better version of the original, which is one generation earlier than this one, somewhere hiding in a file in the computer at JPL. Now, is that, I mean, am I saying what you think I'm saying, which is that NASA is diddling with the data? You damn well better be sure I'm saying that, all right? I will hit it right on the head, even if there are certain people in the room who might think that I am using the dreaded C word. Because we have had decades of C. There is nothing but C filling this. And this, of course, now shows you the comparison of the three versions. And I'll leave it to you to decide whether, in fact, this is really raw data that simply has been, shall we say, enhanced in a little different way. There, we'll do it like that, all right? Okay? I mean, it's obvious there's more information. Now, what is the information telling us? Well, JPL would have you believe, NASA would have you believe, that when you look at this, it's just a pile of rocks. And they just say, it's a pile of rocks. When obviously it's got a nose, it's got two eyebrows, it's got a mouth, it's got a symmetry, it's got a crown. It's a face, come on. Now, it's not the same lighting angle as Viking, true, but then you put a flashlight under your chin in the bathroom and no one would recognize you either, as I said a little while ago. The point is that, you know, Orwell is alive and well and living on the internet, as a friend of mine named Mike Barra posted a couple days ago. This is unquestionably an eroded facial monument, unequivocally. And Tom Van Plandern tomorrow will go through a completely separate analysis, putting in context Cydonia and linking with some of the stuff you're going to see this afternoon. But the bottom line is that this is not just another pretty face. It is the face on Mars seen at different lighting. It is overwhelming confirmation that the damn thing is there, and yet you pick anybody off the street who doesn't listen to Art Bell, or Dan Rather, who doesn't listen to Art Bell for real, and they will tell you that NASA went to Mars, took new pictures, did all the things that science should do, and it just turned out to all be a trick of light and shadow like they knew all along. The big lie. If you tell people watching television what they are not seeing, but what you want them to think they're seeing, a lot of those people will believe you. I don't understand it. I'm sure a lot of you here don't understand it, but there is an unfortunate problem that is, in fact, what happens. So, where does that put us? Well, what we did in terms of the people who have been part of this team is that Mark Carlotto, who is he was at the Analytic Sciences Corporation and now works for another computer imaging firm that has rather intriguing DoD contracts, he went and he worked with the data that JBL had put out, and he was able to create this particular image. And I'll get to what the writing is in a minute. All right? Didn't want to do that. Okay. Now, what we have here on the left is the JPL Parker enhancement and semi-rectification, including beautiful eye sockets, nose, hairline. This nose is remarkable. And here we have Dr. Carlotto's enhancement, all right? And what's really fascinating is he did it going back to his 3D modeling work with Viking. He had rectified the platform. He was able to project from 2D into 3D, and he did a much more accurate rectification than Tim Parker had done. And now it's unequivocal that we're dealing with the face on Mars, seen at different lighting, with stunning correspondences. But those correspondences are also telling a lot of people on our team, starting with myself, and with an artist who we have worked with very carefully called Kinthea Lin, who has been with the project from the beginning, for the last 15 years, that in fact, despite what NASA claimed, this data was overwhelming confirmation that we're dealing with a real facial structure. In fact, to some people it was so overwhelming that they were bold enough to put into print on their website this particular phrase, which I will move over so that we can all see it. Okay, there, and there, and get rid of that, and you'll see that Dr. Van Flandern, the very first evening after he had looked at this data, said that in his considered opinion, there was no longer room for reasonable doubt of the artificial origin of the face mesa, and that in his entire 35-year career, he had never put in print that there was no room for reasonable doubt about anything previous. That, to me, should be the headline on the NASA refotography of the face on Mars, of the Cydonia site on Mars, because that's based on an independent scientific assessment. Unfortunately, for most people, that is not the final word. That is just another opinion. Now, the fact that opinion is based on real science and real analysis and a real history of looking and considering this problem is not taken into account by an awful lot of the pundits and the critics and the people who write science magazines and astronomy and whatever. Well, the interesting aspect of the face when you deconvolve it and do the splits that we did at the UN is that if you take the left-hand side, if you in fact divide it right down the middle and take the right half and fold it over, what you discover is that not only is it a face, but it mirrors to an astonishing degree the symbology so eloquently and so mystifyingly depicted at a place on Earth called Giza. Because the face on Mars, quintessentially now, as we affirmed in our Viking assessments back in 1992, is in fact a man-lion hominid feline composite lying where it has no business being, on the surface of the planet Mars. And this, of course, raises profound questions in terms of what were they, whoever they were, trying to tell us. What were they on Earth at Giza in constructing the Sphinx at 30 degrees north latitude? What were they trying to tell us? Why is this man-lion composite over and over again on two separate worlds now, linked by the geometry that we talked about this morning? Why is that composite so overwhelmingly important? And the answer, all right, now what we're going to do here is this is Mark Carlotto's corrected face done vertically. All right, let me do this and do this. And all you do is you take your hand and you shield the left half. All right, and then just mentally flip it. And you'll see that this guy is a lion. He looks like the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz. Which, of course, gets us to more myth and fairy tale and what in the world was Frank Baum trying to tell us. That's a whole other thing, all right? Now, look at this, all right? Look at this nose, all right? You see the double nostrils? It's a putty tat, for God's sake. Now, what the heck is a mile-long putty tat doing lying, tiger, on the surface of Mars? And why, in the Hindu, do we have a god linked to Mars, whose name I cannot pronounce, who is a man-lion, discovered by my good friend Graham Hancock a few weeks ago? And why are lions lionized, pun intended, in Egypt? Why is the Sphinx simultaneously a lion facing the eastern dawn, identified with Horus the Red, which is Mars, etc., etc., etc.? In other words, there is a mega structure here. There is an incredible set of archetypal proofs of something profound, something going to the heart of who we are and what we have once been, that somebody doesn't want us to know, to the point of where they'll look at this and they'll say, "Ah, trick of light and shadow," after we have dragged them kicking and screaming to take new photographs. And they've done everything they can to impede the science process by giving us stupid data and then lying about it. And it's becoming pretty tiresome. So, moving right along. As we move through this process, all right, and we started looking over and over again, you'll see now this is the composite that I did at the UN many years ago, all right? And below it is the composite. This was the Viking data, all right? This is my allegorical comparison. And this down here is, of course, the real data from Sidonia a la this spring. And we'll start up here, all right? This is Viking. Lighting is coming in this way, so when you flip it, the lighting comes in this way. And here's the allegory. I found that in a poster shop in Berkeley. I really like that. And then this is the astonishing comparison, all right? It's a putty tat. Now, no one mills a mile-long, 1,500-foot-high composite of a man putty tat without having something profound to say about its relevance to the human condition. Because the left-hand side is very, very anthropomorphic. It's very primitive. It looks, in fact, like we are supposed to have looked in the fossil records circa, 300 or so thousand years ago. So the logical inference would be, this is the right-hand side now of the Mars Surveyor image flipped, and you can see that, yes, again, it's lit by that flashlight under the chin, but it's a primitive anthropoid. So if you're looking at art as a multi-leveled language of reality, if the image is to convey the impression going to the heart of the subconscious, bypassing the filters of language as we know it, then this artwork, this stunning artwork, is trying to tell us that somehow we, our primitive ancestry, and a feline image are inextricably intertwined. And then you go to the myths, and you look at all the mythologies and legends of man-lions and the lionization of kings and rulers and, you know, the flag of Britain and the double lions of Egypt and Hanuman, the monkey god, who was kind of the compatriot of the lion-man image in the Hindu mythology. And you begin to get a gestalt that maybe the anthropologists have got it totally wrong. And there has been tinkering at a profound level. And that maybe for political, a la religious reasons, the reigning superstructure simply doesn't want us to go there. Because if we open Pandora's box and ask too many questions about this kind of stunning data, then maybe we're going to find out some things that maybe we wouldn't be unhappy with, but maybe some other folks would be. In other words, we're back to the concept of power. And here it is side by side. Here is the hominid comparison, and here is the feline comparison. So, of course, this brings us to the critical question, what did these guys do besides leave us this rather remarkable image, which is a mile long and over a quarter of a mile high? Well, now this is going to take a little while to load. There is this common perception in the world that we're looking at Mount Rushmore, that even if we're dealing with a sculpture, if we're dealing with a statue, we're dealing with an effigy, a work of art, that that work of art somehow was, you know, a bunch of Martians on an afternoon on a Martian mesa with hammers and chisels. And I've never said that. In fact, I have pretty good data, even back during the Viking days, from Dr. Carlotto indicating that was not what we were going to be seeing if we ever got new pictures. Because, and that's why I title this How to Build a Face 1, if you look at this very carefully, this is now Mark's best enhancement. And believe me, Mark is damn good, all right? Let me show you what I found so overwhelmingly interesting. All right, this is now the cat box image, but reworked. Same lighting, same angle, same everything by Dr. Carlotto. All right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus in on the nose. Yesterday, we were up at this place, the other side, which has this remarkable VR capability, and have constructed, or are in the process, I should say, of constructing an entire game, an exploratory game about going to Sedona. They've written this entire program for me to come up and play, and I brought Tom over, and Rhonda was over there, and we had some other folks, and we had such fun. And these are such bright people, and they're so well motivated, and they also know how to change little boxes that don't work, all right? That helps. And at one point, we're clambering around in these, you know, mech suits, because you sit in these little capsules and you fly with the joysticks and you're in these motorized robotic suits. And you're tromping around at Sedona. I mean, can you imagine 15 years ago that I ever would think that I'd be tromping around in a computer at Sedona based on new pictures that had come down from a space agency that didn't want to show us anything? Life is pretty interesting. And at one point, I'm saying to the gang, because there's like maybe half dozen of us, and I said, let's look for the door. And over the intercom, they all say, door? Door? What door? Are you crazy? What door? Let me show you why I said, guys, look for the door. Because if you look at the nose, you find out that the structure, the face on Mars, is composed of girders. This is an eroded, constructed complex. It is a huge building. It had multiple rooms. Tip your head sideways so you're looking like this. All right, tip it like that. And you have to tip that way, all right? All right? You tip that way, I tip this way, all right? And you'll see there are alignments lining up here and other alignments here, and these things right down here are, in fact, the structural girders of the face on Mars. The thing is hollow. It is a huge manufactured structure. Now, how do I know that? Because back when Viking was giving us this data, And Mark was, let me pull up the next one here, all right? And Mark was looking at it with his fractal computer program. What we did is, what he did was to ask the computer to basically look for fractal or non-fractal imaging, meaning things that are self-similar. Let me start with the thing on the right here, okay? This is an aerial photograph of a B-52 site, some Air Force base, I forget exactly where. Real photograph, you can see the shadow of the airplane here, and here's a B-52 here, and here's revetments and fueling and all that, all right? Down below, there is what is called a fractal image of the same picture. And what the computer is doing is flagging as bright areas that are non-self-similar, meaning areas that don't match the surrounding pixel, that don't match the surrounding landscape. Natural processes tend to create the same scale over and over and over and over and over going down, like little serrations on the edge of leaves or the winding of rivers down through terrain. If you look at the tributaries on rivers, they have the same general winding shape as the main river themselves, because these processes are called fractal. They reduce in scale but maintain the same pattern. Mankind, intelligence, when it plunks stuff down in landscapes, doesn't know about this scale, unless you're Frank Lloyd Wright. And most architects are not, believe me. So what it does is it makes an artificial thing that goes clunk in the middle of the natural landscape. And what the computer can be asked to do is to simply match the numbers. It's looking for things that are similar versus things that are not. And then, qualitatively, we say, okay, the things that are not are probably artificial. In this case, the biggest, brightest, whitest thing is the B-52, which stands out like the proverbial sore B-52. No. Anyway. Now, let me move to the right here, all right? What Mark did was the same computer technique with the face on Mars. All right, here's the face on Mars, all right? Here's surrounding mesas, all right? Now, we'll go down. I can do this, all right? Right here is the fractal image, and lo and behold, the face on Mars, like the B-52, shows up as the damnedest non-fractal thing on the landscape. It does not belong. And the computer doesn't know it's supposed to be a face. It just says, these pixels don't fit. So when NASA has said for all these years, it's just another Martian mesa on a sunny Martian afternoon, they don't know what the hell they're talking about, because the computer says, no, it's not just another mesa. It's different. And it can give us a number of how different it is. So you put that together with the concept of B-52 and its non-fractal image, and face, and it's non-fractal. I mean, look at the signal-to-noise ratio. The face on Mars stands out as much as a damn B-52 on a runway to this computer. What is that telling us? It's telling me that whatever natural process was going on Mars, at work on this mesa, it literally, over how many hundred thousand years that thing had been there, based on other data, the landscape had not reduced it to fracticality. Is that a word? It is now. In other words, it did not go back to natural. It did not fit the pattern. The only thing, logically, that I felt could resist those forces of erosion and destruction and chemical erosion would be a very artificial set of structures. In other words, from this data, years ago, I had projected in monuments that the face on Mars and the surrounding structures that were non-fractal had to be made of artificial stuff. They had to be built in a very artificial way. And when we got there, we should see their artificiality. They are not just sculpted Mount Rushmores. They are built of stuff. They are manufactured things. And so, lo and behold, when we get to Mars, all right, and we get new data, and this is it, and we look close up at the nose of the face on Mars, we find there's all kinds of intricate grid work and geometric structure, and that this extends over a large extent of the image. For instance, let's look back here, all right? Take a look right here above the nose. Look at this structure, all right? And again, it's oriented. See, it has sharp edges, and it's got curves like it's bashed steel or bashed Kevlar or bashed something. It's artificial stuff. It's been viciously eroded by sandblasting, by chemical erosion, and by maybe outside forces, outside agents. But there is this structure all over the damn thing. So it is an eroded building. It is in the extreme, possibly, headquarters. Headquarters? Because Cydonia was the prime meridian of Mars. Now, how can we prove that? We don't have time now, but we can prove it, all right? And it links back to Giza. It links back to the fact that Giza was once the prime meridian of planet Earth. So what we're looking at here is this extraordinary saga, this sweeping template of a history that has literally vanished into the mists of our own memory and time. And if you doubt this, what you do is you simply look at the details. All right, in monuments I said that the features of the eyebrows would basically be determined by pyramidal substructures. All right, sophisticated placement of shadow casting pyramidal substructures on the underlying mesa is the apparent means of achieving the overall facial resemblance at all lighting and viewing angles, meaning a built up thing. We then go to the new image, we look in close up, we'll go here, and lo and behold, we have a artificial, highly geometric looking set of eroded pyramidal substructures making up the illusion. Very sophisticated optical engineering illusion of a face at different lighting angles. Now, why would they do this? Why would they not just carve a face? Well, perhaps they knew that over enough time, if you just carved a face, it would be eroded down to a nubbin. It would be a smooth hill. But if you do it this way, it will resist the erosion and will last a lot longer. And when we someday climb back up to where we achieve spaceflight again, their great, 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 great descendants would be able to look at this on a set of orbital pictures, and it would jog a racial memory, and they would want to go home to figure out what had happened in between. And that's what we think we're going to be able to document in the next couple of days. All right, that was... Okay, let me get rid of some of these here. I'm moving as fast as I can, Charlie. And this, of course, shows the nose detail. We've already gone through that. So this is the girder bit, by the way. All right. Look at this. All right. Let me just pop this up. All right. These are girders. Huge mega structure. Now, are they steel? I don't think so. They're made of something really neat. Can you imagine if Anaconda or some other mega corporation were to fund a private mission and go there and figure out how they built this stuff and bring it home and make it for us? I mean, there's gold in Endar Hills. If we unfetter the space program, get it out of the hands of the black guys who basically are trying to keep everything secret, and move it into the white, into the light, into the democracy that we should be enjoying, and we only have the illusion thereof, this planet will face stunning potentials and options and possibilities, because we are now living in a solar system where somebody, maybe ourselves, a long time ago, left us a stunning heritage. And that heritage ranges the gamut from technology and physics and energy to the ultimate heritage, which, as Tom Bearden is going to lay out for you in great detail tomorrow afternoon, the incredible options for biology, for the managing and control and elimination of disease, and for the real physical basis of an extension of human lifespans, which is staggering by current standards. And the only question before the house is, be careful what you ask for. Think through all the implications. Would we want to live 10,000 years? Okay. Yes. Look at the straight edges, all right? And what you're going to look for are parallels. See? And then you look at right angles and you see other things that are parallel. If you've ever seen an old radiator core that's been
attacked by, you know, sulfuric acid and the stuff that's in the water and the coolants you put through your radiator. It starts out a nice, clean, pristine honeycomb, and it gets eaten away. Well, this looks like a radiator core that's been eaten away. To a structural engineer, you can see there are too many straight lines and there's too many cavities in there to be natural. Now, would I like 10 times better resolution? Of course. I don't have it. So I have to punt with what we got. All right. Let me move rapidly on here because we're running out of time and I want to give Tom and Tom enough. Fortunately, it's going to be disproportional. Tom Van Flannen is going to get the lion's share of the rest of the afternoon, and then Tom Bearden tomorrow is going to blow our socks off. All right. But he'll have just enough time to do the groundwork. All right. Now, this is the second MGS image. Over here, all right, the one that went past the city square and appeared to get only these things over here that at this resolution don't look very interesting. Well, don't be fooled, all right? Let's go and look in detail at what we got. Because one of the first things we got, again, flying in the face, pun intended, of those who said that there was nothing interesting at Sidonia, is this. Now, the image on the left is Giza. The image on the right is Mars. And there is a stunning pyramid on the Martian surface, beautifully square, with an incredibly elegant filigree at the four corners and something very complex at the top. But look at the cross lines, all right? If you look at this in comparison to this, all right, look at the cross lines. Now, this and this are of comparable size. In other words, we have, unequivocally, a Giza-scale pyramid at Sidonia on Mars. Now, that should be enough to end the discussion. You cannot get pyramidal mountains, particularly with very interesting detail at the buttresses, including this gadget down here. So we'll look at that in detail, all right? And then I have a little surprise about the pyramid, which, I'll get rid of that. And then, I wind up talking to myself a lot when I'm doing this. It's a professional problem. I'm trying to get help. It could be a Mac. Is he still with us? Or have they moved him out of Seattle yet? Okay. Now, this is a very image-intensive file. This is 12.4 megs. And I'll tell you why I did this, okay? Because if you now use the best programs that we have, including an image program called... By the way, the second image was much better. The light values of the Viking data at the high sun angle were about 120 dn, 120 digital numbers. Somehow, between the first image on April 5th, and the second image that Mike took on April 14th, he learned better how to work his camera. And on the second image, he gave us about 100, 125 dn as compared to 42 on the first image. Same time of day, same lighting, but somehow he was able to take a better picture. And on the better picture, of course, you have much better signal to noise, and you can do a lot more work with enhancement because you're not enhancing the noise. And so look at what we've got in this incredible, stunning image of the pyramid. Now, let me see if you see what is here, all right? What do you see all over this pyramid? Lines, cross lines, a grid work. Oh my God, a grid work. Remember what I said in Monument, that the pyramids of Mars were not like those of Egypt. They were huge artificial ecologies, architectural ecologies a la Paolo Soleri. They were extraordinary, exquisite, high-tech, manufactured, super, super, super condominiums with thousands upon thousands upon thousands of complexes and rooms and all this. And what we see by applying the best image processing that the state-of-the-art can give us, including a program called Maximum Entropy Deconvolution that comes direct from the Space Telescope Institute at NASA itself, is we find that this pyramid is an astonishing complex of eroded structures now missing its covering,
because that would go first because of erosion, because of chemical erosion, oxidation, whatever, sandstorms. And what you're doing is you're looking down from a few hundred miles, almost straight down in this case, at the interior of room after room after room. Let me just focus right on the apex, all right? And you can see this incredibly intricate pattern. Gridwork, lines, right angles, verticals. There is no doubt in my mind that we are looking at massive arcologies, not natural pyramids or natural pyramidal mountains or pyramids made of limestone blocks. And so when we redesign the Sidonia thing, guys, we have an incredible treasure now to work with, because these are the scale of man-made mountains which tend to collapse and erode like mountains, but they're not. And getting in and all the safety problems and the dangers and the pitfalls, I mean, there is an extraordinary level of interesting gamesmanship involved in really exploring what Sidonia is really trying to tell us. So there's a stunning amount of work and opportunity here for people who someday are going to be able to take this gaming system and physically go where we all would like to go and explore some of the unknowns about Sidonia that we're just too shy to publish, but we would put maybe in a game so you could find it. Anyway, all right, let me see. I'm getting close to the end here. Which, of course, brings us to the quintessential question, which is, what the hell happened? Where did the Martians, cum us, go? All right? Because they left us all kinds of other things. For instance, on the outliers of that pyramid, we find this astonishing structure, which when you look at it in close-up, looks like this, with battlements and with partitions and verticality. In other words, a 3D hollow. I call it the Castle of Barsoom because I wanted to give Edgar Rice Burroughs some credit here, but of course it's not a castle. It's an exquisite high-tech structure, purpose totally unknown, in ruin. It looks in part like it had collapsed and fallen down a bit, but it's clearly not a natural mesa or plateau. It's got too much symmetry, too much design. Every architect I've shown it to goes, wowie, sowie, even the Egyptians that I've shown it to. And I can't pronounce what they say in Egyptian, okay, Arabic. My good friend Yusuf Amin in Los Angeles is absolutely stunned by what he's seeing. So where does NASA come off telling us that we took the pictures and it's just, you know, tricks of light and shadow and there's nothing really exciting on Mars? I mean, do they go to the same damn planet the rest of us paid to go to? I guess not. Now, this is one of those little mounds which is located on the southwest portion of the city. I don't have time to show you. We will in the video. We'll do a little map and we'll do little arrows. And, you know, video is so wonderful because you get to work in post-production. They'll never know we have the lighting problem, right? Look what's down here facing this eroded pyramid. This is a huge pyramidal arcology. You can actually see, if I go close up, you can see the herringbone pattern. Do you see the lines like this? You can actually see the flooring and we're talking amazingly ancient, sagging wonders and magnificence across, even on Mars, hundreds of thousands of years, if not maybe millions, if Tom is correct. A lot has happened. And yes, it's now almost gone. But oh, did it look incredible when it was new. And in the front, down here, you can see a remarkable, astonishing, six-sided crater. Six-sided crater? Hexagons? You gotta be kidding. Not in my universe. Which brings us, if I can do this very elegantly now, I need to find the right way to do this, okay? Which brings us to Tom Van Flandern. Because what Tom is going to describe is an extraordinary possibility that, in fact, there is an explanation for what's happened to the planet Mars. there is a stunning set of possibilities. That in fact, in this solar system, in the last several million years, several prior members of the solar family have exploded, have for some unknown reason that we think, Tom Bearden and I think, is now connected to this physics, one day decided to blow up. Or maybe they were blown up. Maybe the soap opera of the human condition is a lot longer but hasn't really changed all that much. Maybe we've learned nothing, which would be kind of sad. But we don't know that yet, so we can't go there. We have to keep going to find out if that's where we're going to wind up. The most extraordinary piece of information that Tom has brought to the table, well, I'm going to let him tell you, all right? Because what he has brought to this investigation through 25 separate years, not knowing that we would be pursuing the road to Cydonia, is now so correlating, is so extraordinarily convergent, and paints such a stunning picture of who we once may have been and who we can become again, that he deserves to have the stage to do it for himself.